aviation has changed a lot in 60 years. Pilot standards, not so much. I'm Paul Platt, and this is Aero News. Welcome into this Aero News special feature, and thanks for downloading us today. My guest is Bob Miller, a Buffalo, New York area CFI, who is also the writer of Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot, which you can get on the internet. And Bob now has put some of his theories into work at Bob Miller Flight Training, which is located at the Lancaster Airport near Buffalo, New York. Bob, thanks for joining us today.
As always, Paul, my pleasure.
We have touched on this first topic before, Bob. We're going to go over something from your March 1st edition of Over the Airwaves. And it's an article you entitled The Passing Grade. Somewhere in the history of academia, it was decided that if a student comprehended at least 65 or 70% of the course content, he or she would be considered to have passed the course. It did not necessarily mean that he had a command of the content or fully understood the subject matter. And you go on to relate this to flight training and note that, there's a difference between being 65 or 70% proficient at what your job skill is going to be someday or what your general life preparation is going to be, and being 65 or 70% proficient at the skills you need to stay alive for the next 60 seconds. Tell us why you call this the aviation paradox.
Well, it is a paradox in the sense that if we pass a test, an FAA test with 70% score, and then do nothing with what we've learned over the next couple of months or even years, we know that the amount that we knew at the time we took the test has deteriorated dramatically. Unfortunately, this deterioration in knowledge and skills occasionally results in an untoward mishap, an accident, or fatality. When we study history or mathematics or English in public school, and we're not performing to our best capacity, in other words, we just barely get by, the adverse consequences in most cases are not life-threatening. But in aviation, they are life-threatening. Typically, however, anything that has to do with what we do in aviation tends to be set at passing the grade, attaining the rating. For example, when applying for an airline job or a corporate piloting job, typically the interviewer is looking for ratings, looking for hours of total flight, looking for a bit of college. And that's about it. Whether or not an individual excelled in any of those areas is not really a matter to be discussed. It's just a question, do you meet the basic qualifications?
Well, and the way the business is going right now, Bob, there's going to be even more pressure downward on that bar because they're looking for 250-hour pilots now pulling them out of Part 141 flight schools. The instructors are disappearing to go to the regional airlines.
Well, that's the state of the industry as it is today, and of course, supply and demand will always rule. But where do we draw the line? In fact, that line is being drawn very, very liberally, I understand, in some instances, where it's even below 200 hours, where individuals, I've heard over in the European market, individuals now are being trained by the airlines ab initio, going right into the cockpit in the right seat of airliners with very little, if any, independent experience. So where do we draw the line? And the line needs to be drawn from the perspective of what outcomes we wish to achieve. And unfortunately today, the outcomes in general aviation are still fairly dismal. We still are 100 times at greater risk, a mile or hour for hour in flight, than we are in the airlines. So that's what's driving my thoughts on the standards. If the standards are reduced to a level to meet the demand, is safety going to be compromised? And that's really the basic question.
All right. Now, you point out that the standards that are set in this area were made 65 years ago, when we were getting into World War II, pilot training got formalized, and really haven't been touched since. If anything, there are ways to get in the air now that require fewer hours of instruction than they did in 1940.
Yes, and we have to ask ourselves what is bringing this about. Is it because airplanes are becoming simpler to fly, the airspace is less complicated, or are they being brought to bear by just the masses of pilots who want to enjoy a lower standard? I think we have to realize intellectually that the airplanes are not safer to fly. They are more complex. The airspace is more complex, but we really don't have a mechanism to raise the standards proportionally. And you know, there's lots of forces at work in this regard. But one of the forces is if we as a group of pilots advocate for a higher standard, let's say 60 hours instead of 40 hours for the private pilot certificate, and we all agree that that might be a reasonable increase in standard, I think there's an innate fear that if we support that one increase in standard, that the feds may just take that as license to run and increase the entire level of the playing field. It's the old camel's nose in the tent door. If we allow just one tightening of the standard, are we giving license to increase willy-nilly all of the standards? And that's a natural concern, and I think that's one that has to be addressed.
All right, and we will address that in the second half because I want to take a break here, but there are a couple of reasons why it's not likely the standards will get raised anytime soon, and I want to get into that. Bob Miller is my guest, a CFI in the Buffalo, New York area. You can read the entire article on which we're basing our discussion today at overtheairwaves.com. I'm Paul Flack. You're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
At Cirrus Design, we don't ignore the fundamentals of aviation design. We just give them an ingenious new interpretation. The Cirrus SR20 G2. Interested in a substantial airplane that remains practical and affordable? Whether you're a non-pilot looking to begin flying lessons, a pilot needing personal transportation, or a fleet customer selecting the best plane to meet the demands of a multiple aircraft operation, consider the SR20 G2. To learn more, call 888-750-9927 or check us out on the web at cirrusdesign.com.
Welcome back to this Aero News special feature. I'm Paul Plack, and my guest is Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves. We're talking about the standards you have to meet to become a private pilot these days, and for that matter, an instrument or commercial pilot, and how the bar hasn't really been raised in a long time. And we're going to talk for a couple minutes about why it's not likely to be raised anytime soon. Bob, you mentioned already supply and demand and, you know, the lower time being expected of candidates for airline jobs now. And I have to observe that when people talk about the law of supply and demand, they're really leaving a third of it out because it's actually the law of supply, demand, and price. And you can solve any supply-demand problem by adjusting price as well. And I guess what would have to happen in this case is if we required 60 hours for someone to become a private pilot, or if we went back to requiring 500 or 1,000 or 1,250 hours, whatever, for someone to get an entry-level job in the right seat of an airliner, we'd have to raise the price. We'd have to raise what we paid these people in order to draw them out of the woodwork to get into the system in the first place. And that means that ultimately the ticket price to the passenger would have to go up. It seems to me there's a whole bunch of things here saying no.
There are. Clearly there are many things. And the point you raise about prices is valid. Beyond belief, in the sense that we can limit the number of new pilots starting simply by the price that we set to enter the club, if you will, to acquire the certificates. But as evidence of the complexity of it is, if we do not raise the standard, then individuals are getting in at lower cost initially. But if we do not raise the standard, accident rates are going to be the adverse consequence. They have to be. We know that training translates to safety, ergo less training, less safety. So then we have to look at what is the cost of a single accident to all of us as pilots. The insurance cost that I have to pay, for example, on the late model Cessna 172s in my new flight school, I mean, it's at a cost that is almost triple what my colleagues paid just a few years back. And that's a direct result of the risks that the insurance companies perceive in conducting flight training. Now, if we took this down the road a little bit and could convince the insurance companies that for those of us who will not sign off students or that raise the bar, if you will, give us a lower premium, and in turn, we promise to have or produce a lower accident rate. Well, Paul, that's a long-term kind of an analysis that we would almost have to take on faith. So, yes, it is a very complicated practice, but I think what we have to do is look at this almost the way the military looks at battle losses. What is an acceptable loss rate? Right now, we're losing one aircraft a day, on average, a fatal accident. Is that an acceptable a loss rate? Well, you know, when we think of the total number of hundreds of thousands of hours flown, it's a remarkably high safety record. It's probably better than, certainly better than riding a bicycle. If you look at the large accident rates from a larger perspective, but is that an acceptable loss rate? I don't know. You tell me.
Well, you mentioned a couple of specific things that would go into raising the bar. Stop publishing the answers to the knowledge tests. Tightening the practical test standards, and in particular, you talk about a tolerance of plus or minus 100 feet in straight and level flight instead of 200. And obviously, that's going to become a more important skill when they start getting into, RNAV and some of the performance requirements in the new airspace system. And then 3 hours of actual instrument conditions. Now, you've been on this one for quite a while. No more foggles or the hood. You want people in actual instrument conditions for 3 hours to get their private certificate.
Well, we know that the number one cause, weather-related cause of accidents, fatal accidents, is continued VFR flight into IMC conditions. And I personally believe, having worked with a number of students that have come to me for instrument proficiency checks and whatnot, if an individual has never been in the clouds before, is instrument rated, but took all of his or her training in with a view-limiting device of some sort, you can see the beads of sweat falling down their foreheads. You really can. There is just in my opinion, it's a cruel hoax to allow a student to believe that simulating IFR conditions is the same as the real thing. The fact that we can even sign off CF double eyes, these are instrument instructors who themselves have never been in the clouds, is another cruel hoax. But I don't know why that's the case. Perhaps it's because of the lobbying influence of Arizona and Florida and New Mexico flight schools, and say, realistically, we can't even get IFR conditions. But if you look at the accident data, there is a reason why people become disoriented in the clouds, even though they've had the requisite training. Why is this happening?
Well, you point out some good opportunities for improvement here. I have to say you leave us on somewhat pessimistic note in terms of it ever happening, but in some of these cases, we're our own worst enemies. And, Bob, I'm going to invite our listeners to read more on this topic in your writings and over the airwaves this month. And as always, we appreciate your thought-provoking Mondays, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Thanks a lot, Paul.
Bob Miller's website is overtheairwaves.com, and you've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. On the web, you'll find us at www.aero-news.net. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.